It takes a little click here and a click there, and off we run.
Fantastic.
Yes. Oh, it's amazing what the technology. Let's see.
So how have you been? Oh, I guess we're live.
Very good. Yeah. Well, we're just going live in about 3 seconds. There we go on YouTube. Thanks for joining me, everyone. Charles Moskowitz here, Monday through Friday, 12 noon to 1 p.m. and other times as well on YouTube and all of the subscribing platforms. And my guest is Susan Bradford. Susan is the author of Royal Blood Lies, the inside story of how the Rothschilds took over the British monarchy, purged royals, created puppet leaders, waged revolutions, corrupted morals and institutions, plundered wealth, created false realities, and pitted nations, societies, and peoples against each other in a ruthless, megalomaniacal quest for world domination. Susan, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Susan, before we get started, just talk a little bit about yourself and your background, and so we can get an idea of how it is that you arrived at this thesis.
Sure. So I am a journalist. I spent a few years in England. I earned my master's from the University of Essex in England in international relations. And during that time, I founded the European Review, which what became a departmental publication for the Center for European Studies. As editor, I was able to research the European economic, strategic, political aspects of European integration. I was also able to work with European elites who were involved with this. And in the process, I was invited to join the Atlantic Council of the UK as a senior research fellow. And I worked also as a in media and PR for the European Movement, which was founded by Winston Churchill to kind of promote European integration. And as I was researching European integration, I actually found out that it was not as benevolent as our leaders had made it out to be. So that is a start.
Well, it's interesting because you're very much a kind of, by your credentials, an establishment person, an establishment player. You're not some out there, deviation of the norm, as it were. And the Atlantic Charter, by the way, was established by Churchill and FDR in advance of World War II. It was essentially a kind of a both an explicit and implicit agreement that the United States
that the United States
to that war on the side of the British, and that it began the
correct.
lend-lease process by which the US illegally, under international law standards, began to supply the British side, and we started to take your
That
thesis
is
goes back to the Roman times, and basically, I want to put it into a nutshell because the overall thesis is something that I resonate with and that I agree with. I'm
And
not
then I
sure I
with
can go along with some of the specifics, but the idea is that there is this informal international-oriented elite that tends to interact with and intersect
and
with
intersect
all
with
these various
all
moving
these various
parts that's made up of free trade, international
trade
movement,
international
and globalists who seek to have a
to have
world
a
order.
That's correct. And also briefly to go back to the Atlantic Charter. Interestingly enough, Bill Clinton fulfilled the Atlantic Charter. He was hopefully you can hear me okay.
Yes, I'm fine.
Yes, I'm fine.
Okay. He was the biological son of Winston Churchill and Pamela Harriman. So he was sent over to the United States as a child to fulfill the Atlantic Charter. By generating enough wealth during his administration to actually to pay back what they had, what we had lent them in terms of, for military support and so forth. So Bill Clinton was one of their agents. To go back to like how this all got started, the roots are actually in the Roman Empire, which was the beginnings of Western civilization. And the time was the chronology was set up through the Gregorian calendar with BC and AD, with BC being representing before Christ, AD representing Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. So Jesus Christ had set was the basis for the beginning of Western civilization. The early Roman emperors actually were initiated into the divine right to rule. So they were initiated into like the Judeo-Christian, you know, thoughts the secrets of that religion. An elite and sacred bloodline was also established. So this was going to be a Western civilization that was ordered under God, with the rulers, you know, serving the people, investing in sciences and the arts, and, you know, expanding commerce that would benefit community at large and not just a private elite. Now, these rulers were challenged by the ancient Phoenicians, who were a very predatory mercenary force that they dominated the seas for many centuries. And part of their domination was attributed to their alliances with these nomadic forces that they partnered with. These were like Mongolians, Khazarians, Turkish forces who were steeped in the occult. They also drew upon Asian logic, and like, which is also Aristotelian logic, that is rational thinking, completely stripped of morality, virtue, ethics, and which denies God's existence because they wanted to be God. They didn't want to worship God. So their worldview was that of a tyrannical leader, which they'd like to, you know, they'd like to aspire to become themselves, with the entire society ordered under them and working and moving in lockstep. So the elites working through the Venetians were attempting to usurp the divine right to rule. They collapsed the Roman Empire, which then divided between the Byzantine Empire and the Holy Roman Empire. The Byzantine Empire would eventually fell to corruption. And these Venetians would then try to kind of insinuate themselves into positions of power. You know, they made a beeline to governments and to areas of commerce. And since their own maritime force was crumbling under corruption, they sought to insinuate themselves into England, because England was a rising maritime power. It had established the East India Company, which was a very benevolent enterprise. It was set up under Queen Elizabeth I to accommodate the merchants of London, who wanted to establish new markets in the American colonies and around the world. But once the Venetians entered into their, they began to partner with the merchants of London through the East India Company. The East India Company then transformed into a force for imperialism. So they would kind of merge these mercenary forces that would conquer the areas in which they were doing business, eradicate the populations, strip those areas of their wealth, and then, you know, commandeer the land, the territory, the resources for themselves. So that was one of the original forces. And I could, if you'd like, I can, you know, go to different directions depending on the areas.
Let's just go over a little bit what you have here. My understanding is that the whole concept of the emperor god, the divine right of kings, was really started by Julius Caesar, and by particularly his nephew Augustus Octavius.
Correct.
Who actually called himself a son of God, or a god king.
Yes, he did.
And that Christianity essentially abolished that idea, because Christianity, of course, said that Jesus was Christ as opposed to some earthly entity. And the idea of the divine right of kings was then transferred to a kind of a more regulated thing under the Roman Catholic Church. I'm getting some feedback here. And, you know, it was limited in its power, and eventually the idea would be abolished by the founding fathers of the United States, who viewed all divine power coming from the creator of the universe and then granted to the citizen who has limited power under God. It was very much based on this, what actually is the Judeo-Christian ideal, that all rights come from God, not from the state. And that, you know, the state then, the citizen under God then gives the state limited powers. Now, the other thing I want to ask about is the business of the Venetians. I mean, you say that they actually got off the ground during the Roman Empire period. I thought it was after the collapse of the Roman Empire. And
It was more like with the, during the Byzantine Empire, during that period, right? After the collapse, that's correct.
And then you essentially link them as international merchants who were trading in the East with the Silk Road and who were trading, throughout the Mediterranean and possibly the Atlantic and other city-states too, not just the Venetians, the Genoese, the Pisans. I mean, there were others as well. And then in the Baltic Sea, you had the Hanseatic League, which was also engaging in trade, and they developed a concept of credit and insurance and how to, insure shipments properly. It was actually the Venetians that first invented paper currency. And I think that they possibly learned it from the early Islamists. But you feel that this development was then transferred to England once Venice began to decline, and that they took over the East India Company, which became an international trading company that was involved with the resurrection of slavery, and then eventually, once they started to abolish slavery, they got into the drug dealing and the opium trades. Am I on to that, or?
You are, and also just to kind of respond to what you said earlier about the divine right to kings. Now Jesus actually established the divine right to kings. That's a topic for a different book, but that was established by Jesus, and that a person was not to deny the individual of their the rights or God-given rights. In fact, the king, the divine right to kings acknowledged that the people had those rights given to them by God, and they sought to protect them. Now, the Vatican sought to usurp the divine right to rule and to claim that authority for itself, and that's where some of the conflict came between the Protestants and the Vatican. But what you've said about the Venetians is correct. I believe that the Rothschilds were, I can only go so far back within into their lineage, but they were able to acquire access to the East India Company through Prince William the Ninth, who was a prince of Hanover. King George was also an electorate to Hanover, and so through by financing the prince of Germany of well, what would later become Germany, he was able to work with Oppenheimer Bank and then acquire business with the East India Company. The East India Company had been chartered by the monarchy, and so he was therefore able to acquire business with the British king himself, and then. And through these different relationships with the Venetians, they began to stir up conflict and skirmishes between both sides, between the monarchy and then the colonies, in order to kind of separate the British monarchy from its colonies to weaken both economically, as for the purposes of dividing and conquering them both.
Okay, so the book is Royal Blood Lies, and my guest is the author, Susan Bradford. Susan, I think that the Rothschilds were one of the many big private banking families
Yes, they
that have
were.
developed, and it goes even before that. We could go back to the Fuggers, who were a Catholic family in Bavaria, and other similar families. A lot of them were Italian families, maybe connected to the Venetians.
Yes, they were.
And they developed these private merchant banking houses, which are still around and which are secretive and which do lend money to princes and governments, and then have been linked to war as a way to collect debt. There's a lot that's been written about their various involvements that led to World War I. But I have to tell you, I think that a lot of this stuff is secret. You seem to have information on it. I'm not discounting it. It's fascinating. It's well-meaning. But I find that a lot of the things we're talking about, they really are secret, and we can't know for sure. And it seems to me that with regard to the Rothschild family, you might be a bit involved in some overreach. I mean, you link them to controlling both the communist revolution. You say that Adolf Hitler was a grandson of the Rothschilds, and he was controlled by the Rothschilds. the British, they controlled everything, China, the United States. I find that to be a little bit, to be, with due respect, a bit of a stretch. I think that, maybe I'm being a normie here, going on conventional wisdom. All right, I'll grant you. But it seems to me that the Rothschild family lost influence as a result. You know, their pinnacle of power was in the early 19th century. And then they really eventually lost influence during World War II, because the Viennese branch of the family had all their property confiscated and they were driven out of the country. The Nepalese branch of the family had dissipated because they had no sons, and the daughters basically married into other families, and the center of that fell apart. And the German family also was severely diminished because of World War II. The only branch of the Rothschild family that came out of that was the British branch. And they're still there today. And they are powerful, but I'm not sure that they have quite this sweeping international power that you suggest. I don't know if they're really on the world scene quite that vigorously and that unified. By all means, you can make that case. I mean, and by the way, I want to be clear here. You know, by talking about the Rothschilds, you're not an anti-Semite. This isn't
correct. Because
we don't know whether they're Jewish or not, quite frankly. But
Jesuits,
to the degree that they might have some link to Judaism, is not relevant. And by the way, they are not particularly pro-Israel, I might add, except for one member, that being one of the sons, Edmund, who actually was pro-Israel, but most of them were not. They tend to be, somewhat establishment internationalists who are amoral, and they're very typical of most of these families. They just they'll go wherever the money is, and they will play people off against each other. I guess that my objection is that you're putting a lot of emphasis on them as opposed to this broader issue of an interlocking international elite. And I think that might be somewhat dangerous to do. That's all.
Okay, that's a very fair criticism, and I'll try to link it, make those connections for you if I'm able to. So as you can imagine, that the Rothschilds were the financiers on all sides of the Napoleonic Wars. During the Napoleonic Wars, they were able to crash the British stock market. In so doing, they were able to acquire birthrights into the British royal family. So that's how they were able to establish an illegitimate royal bloodline. They also fomented revolutions within England and throughout Europe to essentially level the aristocrats and to acquire a large degree of their wealth and power. And then once they acquired the birthrights into the British monarchy, they then established a secret breeding program where they then bred themselves into other royal bloodlines throughout Europe. And of course, Hitler and Stalin were among their bloodlines, as was Mao. And so they were able to kind of work behind the scenes through their own, through their own heirs.
Now that's incredible. Look, I mean, on the surface, we know that that's how the aristocracy works. I mean, look at the classic example of that is the Habsburgs, who were
correct.
They were brilliant at intermarrying and interlocking. We know that before World War I, you had Tsar Nicholas II and King George V of England, and the Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany were all first cousins. You know, and so you had this kind of ongoing interlocking, intermarrying European royalty that probably goes all the way back to the days of the Merovingians. And there's a lot on that. If you took a look at the work around the study of the Priory of Zion and the Carolingians, who were all these people? They all were, kind of interrelated, and they would conduct diplomacy. I mean, a good example of that in fiction is Game of Thrones, right? You know, the daughter would marry into this family. I mean, Genghis Khan did this as well. I mean, his daughters would go in as he conquered a country, and they would marry the king. And then then Khan would send the king out to war where he'd probably be killed, and the daughter would run the country, And so you had, this isn't new, this idea of interlocking bloodlines. I think it's also true with regard to some of the Jewish banking houses in the United States. There's a good book by Birmingham called Our Crowd, which shows how the the Seligmans and the Schiffs and the Warburgs and the, you know, the Goldmans and the Saxes and the Lehmans, they all kind of would marry each other's, the daughters would marry the sons, and they would keep this, you know, this interlocking development in the family. So, you know, and we could take a look, it's not particularly unique to the Jewish line either, because you've got the same thing going on in other denominations where, you know, the Rockefellers were doing this. I mean, they would use marriages as a way of conducting diplomacies and, you know, keeping this sort of informal, international oriented elite in power. So I don't doubt that. It's a fascinating subject. It's one that you go into in terms of looking at, you know, who was marrying who and how this worked. I just don't know if the Rothschilds are at the epicenter of it. That's all.
Okay. That's a fair question. But then when you look at the fact that they were financing these revolutions all around Europe, you can see who benefited from those revolutions, who acquired the power, who lost power. And it all comes back to the Rothschilds, that they were the winners in all of this. But they were operating behind different front organizations and different different figureheads. Once they had acquired control of the British government, the prime minister, one of whom was Lord Palmerston, mentored a number of the revolutionaries throughout Europe, like Giuseppe Manzini, and he who developed the Young Turks and these different revolutionary movements that eventually tore through Europe, stripped the aristocrats of their wealth and power, and those who acquired power, like Napoleon, for example, among others, were either bankrolled or otherwise Rothschild bloodlines. So this was a tactic that they used.
Well, why would the Rothschilds want to, like, for example, you mentioned Mazzini, who was generally viewed in kind of quote unquote conspiracy circles as being the father of the mafia. The Italian mafia.
I didn't know that.
And who also had a series of exchanges of letters with Albert Pike, who was a Confederate general who was the father of the American Masonic movement. And there was a statue of him in Washington, D.C., by the way, which was just torn down by the rioters last summer. It is the only statue in Washington of a non-president, I believe. Very powerful figure, wrote a book called Morals and Dogma, very much involved with American secret societies. You know, fascinating history, but yet, and also there's a connection between Mazzini and other Italian, early Italian communists like Bruno and Buonarroti and others, and the fomentation of Russian communist groups like the Noralia Zemla. And the early, you know, the kind of the genesis of the eventually the Bolsheviks. But I guess that, I mean, why would they want to be fomenting, you know, aristocratic movements when in fact they themselves were aristocrats and they had all of these bloodlines through marriage with other aristocrats? Why wouldn't they be overthrowing themselves?
That's a good question. I mean, their wider agenda was to reestablish the Roman Empire with themselves at the pinnacle of that empire. That was the basis of the European Union. And they also wanted to reestablish the old Venetian trading routes, which, you know, have morphed into like the Silk Road. But I think what the Rothschilds were not born into wealth. I mean, the later generations were. The patriarch was actually fairly poor, and they wanted to usurp the aristocrats, because many of them were Christians. They believed in the divine right to rule, and they were pushing the rational enlightenment, which was to remove God from society altogether. They wanted to be in a position where nobody could challenge them. So in order for them to do that, they would need to target those aristocrats who are not affiliated with them. So they would foment grievances, identifying a group that had privilege. The masses would rise up, or they would subsidize, you know, different radical groups to target those people. Those people might wind up either possibly set up for assassination attempts, but they would lose their property, which would then wind up in the hands of the Rothschilds or their affiliated groups. And the people would not have benefited one iota. So it was more of a tactic to benefit themselves at the expense of other people. And generally they were untouched. And, you know, if, I think sometimes a few of them were, you know, of their bloodlines were sacrificed, for, you know, in the process, but as a whole, their, you know, their dynasty, you know, was emerging as the sole power of the world.
Now, did they play, did these families, and again, I'm not putting it strictly under the rubric of the Rothschilds. I think that it's, okay, it's a network of people.
It is, correct.
Did they play any role in the American Revolution? And if so, what was it?
Yes, they did. That's a good question. So originally the colonies had a very a positive and a prosperous relationship with the British Crown. And there was really very little reason for them to rebel. So the Venetians who were conducting trade with the colonies enlisted a few individuals whom they tapped to be leaders of the revolution, including, for example, Ben Franklin, who recruited Thomas Paine to come to the United States or to the colonies to promote propaganda that would incite revolution. So this was a foreigner, you know, who was coming into the United States, and the revolution was not based on any specific grievances, but rather revolution for the sake of it. And they were challenging the divine right to rule. And again, the reason for that is that if there was a divine right to rule, that would necessarily mean that the Rothschilds or these Venetians could not rule, you know, it could not hold that position. So they determined that the divine right to rule was irrational, it was superstitious, and pursued, you know, like a rational self-interest that pursued power and wealth for its own sake, you know, without any public virtue. So they were, the Rothschilds and these networks were financing the Hessian armies, you know, from Germany that was connected to Rothschild through you know, Prince William.
Right, there, right.
The Venetian merchants had lent their own navy seamen to the British, and the Rothschilds had also bankrolled the colonists. So they were really controlling all sides of that revolution to kind of separate the two.
Well, I mean, I get the fact that the Hessians were employed by the British, but the British essentially launched one of the largest invasions in world history up until that point, when they landed on the American colonies. But the Ben Franklin and the American colonists, I think, were against that. I mean, I think that Franklin has spent many years in Britain observing very positive scientific developments there, how to build, hydropower and windmills and how to develop industry. And he also he brought that knowledge back to the Americans, and the British tried to stop that from happening in the colonies. They took away the money, the scrip, and they replaced it with Bank of England notes, creating a depression. And there were other measures they were taking that essentially were trying to keep the colonies almost as pastoral, you know, like fiefs that the British East India Company could exploit through the triangle trade. They forced the colonies to accept slavery. And I think that all those factors led to the American Revolution, which I think was an organic development. I don't think it was something that was hatched by a bunch of bankers, not to say that they might not have tried to inject and play a role. There certainly were a few of those. But I think that the Rothschilds, or the international banking establishment, did begin to show its hand, I think, during the Civil War. And I think they may have helped foment that war. I think Lincoln rejected their overtures to fund him. Instead, he created, greenbacks. And he said, we don't need to go to borrow money from these cartels of bankers at huge exorbitant interest. We can just create our money ourselves by having Congress issue currency. And I think that might have played a role in why he was assassinated. These are all theories that are out there. Who knows? But either way, I think that the American development, I would view it as being a much more organic, dynamic development that continued to move forward in spite of machinations from internationalists. And we are still dealing with that. I mean, I think the same people deposed Donald Trump and are now putting us back into this kind of province of the world, you know, we're back to this idea of these international elites who are not loyal to any particular nation. In fact, they view the idea of sovereignty as an anachronism and as a superstition. Yeah. They are into this kind of international order. And they're also into what historian Charles Austin Beard referred to as perpetual war for perpetual peace. We're already seeing that now. One of the first things Biden did upon essentially being installed was start to bomb Syria. Now they're raising the saber at other countries. We're back to the same policy that we've been embroiled in since World War I, which is constant war that bleeds our sovereignty, that demoralizes our society, and that kills our young men and women.
Correct. That everything you said is correct. I would, however, disagree with your interpretation of the American Revolution. Thomas Paine had remarked at the time that there was very little interest among the colonists or the British monarchy for war. They wanted to reconcile, and the Rothschilds were actually trying to prevent the colonists from moving westward because they wanted to tap all the natural resources. They were weaponizing the Indians to prevent that from happening.
Right.
And actually the Indians were later corralled onto Indian reservations and then organized into corporations like federally recognized Indian tribes so that the Rothschilds could establish taxpayer supported markets and mine for natural resources and oil beyond the purview of the federal government. So they were able to actually project socialism into the United States through the back door of the Indian tribes. But if you actually research what the colonists had written about the American Revolution and the diplomacy between both sides, you'll see that they did not want war. In fact, they were making every effort to restore peace, but these revolutionaries continued to instigate, actually driving them apart.
So I think that you make the point that most Americans did not want to have war and that there were patriots, I would suggest people like Adams and Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton who did want to see the United States become a sovereign nation. I don't see anything particularly sinister about that. Now, with regard to the Indian reservations, that's interesting. The Indian reservation system wasn't really established until Ulysses Grant. But there was an interesting comment that it makes me think when you talk about this, made by Russell Means, who was a major Native American leader, and who was involved in the Wounded Knee incident in 1973. And he was testifying before Congress, and he said, if you want to see an example of the failures of socialism, look no further than the Indian reservation. These were created as kind of like a dependent states. It was a social experiment. They were, it was also a bit of a eugenic experiment in that their children were taken off the reservation and, they were forced to, assimilate and all of that. So, it's not a good history there. And I think you make a point now, whether or not the Rothschilds had a hand in it, I'd have to see more evidence of that. But the point is, I think it is fair to say that it had the markings of an internationalist, amoral social experiment. It had, with its atheism, with its lack of, respect for nation states and sovereignty and all of that. Let's bring things up to World War II, because these are pretty serious charges. I mean, you claim that Adolf Hitler was the grandson of the Rothschilds, and would that not therefore make him a Jew? And why would they be involved with anti-Semitic machinations of the Holocaust, killing 6 million Jews?
That's a good question. Remember that one of their tactics is to bring in a foreigner to destroy the country from within. So we have Kamala Harris. Russia had Stalin, who was from Georgia. He was a foreigner, and then Hitler was from Austria. His grandmother was a maid in the Rothschild mansion. She was allegedly raped by three of the Rothschild men. Once she became pregnant, they sent her home. Hitler was raised as a very poor tramp. He was unemployed for a while, impoverished, but he received money from private outside sources and was eventually groomed to be leader of Germany. He was trained at the British Tavistock Institute. And the reason that his function was to destroy Germany, which was posing a challenge to British commerce and industry. So they wanted to eliminate Germany as competition. And in terms of why they would want to exterminate the Jews, I don't believe that the Rothschilds are necessarily Jews. They were, however, attempting to steal the Jewish identity. In order for them to do so, they'd have to exterminate the Jews. Two, they would need to create a pretext to create the state of Israel. And they wanted to create Israel for many reasons, one of which was to usurp the divine right to rule. The second was that Israel Jerusalem was at the center of the old Venetian trading routes. And so they wanted to reclaim Jerusalem for that purpose. You can actually see that a number of the early Zionists were actually anti-Semitic, they had a lot of ties to anti-Semitism. So, for example, Chaim Weizmann, who was a president of Israel, he was tapped by Rothschild to lobby the British Parliament to get behind the Balfour Declaration. At the same time, one of his sisters was dating a Nazi. Another was working with Stalin on the doctor's plot. The doctor's plot was intended to kill doctors throughout Russia and then blame those attacks on the Jews to incite anti-Semitism. So while Stalin was a Zionist, he was also creating Nuremberg law, a type of Nuremberg law that was removing Jews from the civil service and persecuting them, stripping them of their assets. Hitler was doing the same in Germany. So it was that, you know, while they were rabid Zionists, they were also very much anti-Semitic. And I believe that a lot of Jews in America were aware of this kind of anti-Semitic Zionist agenda. I think it was before World War II that a number of prominent Jews signed a letter which was submitted to the New York Times, that was pleading with the federal government not to recognize Israel, and they were actually very much opposed to Zionism. Okay. So I think, I don't think Zionism, I don't think it's pro-Jewish.
Well, first of all, Susan, you know, a lot of this is really wild conspiracy speculation. I don't have a problem with it because you're not
documented.
Well, fine. I mean, I'll raise your document with another one. But the point I'm making here is that I don't have a problem with airing this because you're not anti-Semitic and you're not advocating anything that would be harmful to the Jewish people. And I just want to be clear about that. This is all, you know, fine and legitimate speculation. There's no proof of Hitler's ancestry. These have always been rumors out there. I mean, and even if this were true, I mean, does this mean that Hitler consciously knew that he was the grandson of the Rothschilds? And the idea that Hitler wanted to destroy Germany, I think that's dubious. I think that he wanted to build a new Reich that would be a 1,000-year Reich and that would basically conquer, you know, it was supported by the liberal left, by the way, and progressives right up to the moment of Kristallnacht. And, you know, it was seen as a socialistic movement. I think Hitler started out as a communist. I actually wrote a book about this myself called Was Hitler a Leftist? And I have some pretty good documentation there. And that if you look at the Nazi charter, it's very communistic. It's sort of a mirror image of the Communist Manifesto with a little extra, with a biological crackpot stuff thrown in. And that itself goes back to the Illuminati of Adam Weishaupt, which was actually a Catholic-oriented movement that yet sought to overthrow the Vatican and all clerics and rulers in the world. And that's standard history in Europe. And by the way, you have an interesting little footnote there about the Spartacist League as being named after Spartacus Weishaupt, which was, of course, the Bolshevik movement of Germany that sought to overthrow Germany right after World War I. So there's a lot going on here that, I think that as someone who myself has studied these various conspiracy strains over a long period of time, you know, I always want to be careful, because ultimately we're talking again about things that we can't really know about, because by nature they are secret. And I don't for a minute doubt that these things are going on, but I think that we have to be careful when we start to bore in and talk about specifics and specific people. Now, as far as Zionism goes, again, just like the American Revolution and just like the American Patriots, I view Zionism as an organic, dynamic movement by the Jewish people that goes back every generation from the time of the destruction of the Second Temple by the Romans to obtain and reestablish sovereignty in their homeland. It is a political and a religious movement. Judaism, in a sense, is both a political and religious movement itself. It's an ethno-religious movement. And that it happened organically. Now, did they, you know, does that mean that, you know, you didn't have somebody like Chaim Weizmann use maybe people's somewhat jaded view of Jews to the advantage of the Zionist movement? I think he did. Was he an anti-Semite? No. I think that you had people like Weizmann and Theodor Herzl who had a different view, and also Rudolf Hess. Who am I thinking of? Not Rudolf Hess. He was a Nazi.
Yes.
He wrote Rome and Jerusalem. They were socialists. They had a different view of Judaism. They viewed Judaism as a socialistic movement, not as a religion. And, you know, while I could bicker with them, and I think personally that they were wrong, nevertheless, they still viewed the idea of Judaism obtaining independence and becoming sovereign in its homeland and becoming a state among all other normal nations, because that's what the late 19th century's version of, you know, sovereignty was about. I mean, it was very much in line with that. So, I mean, to suggest that they were anti-Semitic, that almost sounds like ultra-Orthodox Judaism might have said that. I just don't think so. I just think that their vision of Judaism was not conventional Judaism. It was leftism dressed as Judaism. And you still have those same views by Jews today who tend to control the high ground of our politics and culture. I think they're wrong, but I don't think they're anti-Semitic, and I think they're well-meaning in many cases.
I don't think being a Zionist can necessarily be equated with being anti-Semitic. I think the top controllers of the Zionist movement would be anti-Semitic. And they grew out of the Venetian Empire with these mercenary forces being told under threat of extermination that they must accept either an Abrahamic faith or face extermination. And some chose Islam, some chose Judaism, but they were neither Jews nor Muslims, but they were, you know, kind of radicals. And I know that, you know, and of course I'm not Jewish, as I'm speaking as a Christian from what I've learned and researched, the Jews had always aspired to their own homeland, even, you know, since the days of the Roman Empire.
Well,
but that homeland, go ahead. Yes, and the homeland didn't necessarily have to be in Jerusalem. It could have been anywhere. Is that correct?
No, that is not correct. There was some talk at the second Zionist conference in Basel for considering an alternative homeland. I think that Bermuda was mentioned, Alaska was mentioned, but that wasn't because, I mean, that was only because at that time it was not viewed as possible. You know, this was at a time when, you know, Palestine, or what was really called South Syria, was a province of the Ottoman Empire, and the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire gave a no to that. The Vatican also said, no, they're not going to help. And that it just looked like an insurmountable problem. And at the same time, there was this groundswell of support among the Jewish communities of the world to obtain some nature of sovereignty in the world. So, you know, that was not generally an organic part of the Jewish people. That was simply something that was debated and discussed and basically shot down at the second Zionist conference in Basel in 1902. I think Uganda was also mentioned, possible homeland. But no, I mean, the idea was always a return to the land of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I mean, that is in the Torah. Every generation of Jews have tried to do this. They have emigrated there. They have always been there. And that there was this sense that they had a command by God to take possession of that tiny bitty swath of land between the Jordan River and the Great Sea. And that's what they've done. Thank God.
But wasn't Israel originally intended to be established under a temple and not under the Knesset? Weren't those the original terms of the establishment?
I think that the idea is to return to the land, take sovereignty. I mean, there's an order to it. And then take control of Jerusalem and then rebuild the temple. And then we will have the age of the Messiah. And that's what's transpired. I mean, 1948, they did take possession of the land. They declared sovereignty against all of the internationalists, against the Rothschilds, Harry Truman had opposition from the Council on Foreign Relations, all these, the General Marshall, his Secretary of State. They were all like, don't do this because we're going to lose business with the Arab countries. We're merchants. We want to have oil. We want to have all these, Palestine, they have nothing. But he stepped forward and did it, almost like the Emperor Cyrus. And they were able to obtain sovereignty and get it recognized. 1967, they took sovereignty over Jerusalem. Now the next step is rebuilding the temple. Now I'm not weighing in on that. I pray that that happens in my lifetime, but it's a very complex issue. I mean, I think if you look at the Book of Kings and you look at the machinations of King Solomon, who did build the temple, you see that he did it in partnership with the Phoenician king Hiram of Tyre, and also with the builder Hiram Abiff, who was not Jewish. And that leads me to think, and again, I'm not a rabbi here, I'm just speculating, that if the temple is ever to be rebuilt, it's going to have to be done with equal and combined efforts between Jews and Muslims. It can't just be done by the Jews, and it can't just be done by the state of Israel. It's going to have to be a Jewish Islamic effort. So that's just my opinion on that, not to get distracted.
What are your thoughts on the Abrahamic Accords?
I think they're a great development. I mean, I think that had Donald Trump not been deposed, we probably would have had the Kushner plan accepted by the Palestinian Arabs, which was a very good and generous plan. It would have given them maximum sovereignty in Judea and Samaria. It would have connected Judea and Samaria to Gaza by a highway or by a train. It would have given them a condominium in Jerusalem for their capital. It was the best plan ever presented. And I think that had Trump not been taken out by this internationalist, free trader, Venetian, illuminated establishment, whatever you want to call it, then that would have come to pass. I mean, if you think about what Trump did accomplish in the brief time that he was there, it's incredible. Peace between Israel and I think it was five Arab states. I mean, just an incredible development. And it's a terrible lost opportunity for the world that this has been stopped. And it's been stopped for reasons, in my opinion.
I thought it was interesting that child is working with the Vatican, inclusive capitalism, with Klaus Schwab, who's the head of the World Economic Forum. So you have the Rothschilds working with the Vatican, to promote this Green New Deal and the Great Reset.
Yes, it is.
It's very much anti-Semitic, and it's
it's anti-nationalist. It's anti-Semitic. It's anti-Christian. I mean, the Vatican seems to me. I don't know what's going on the inside of there, but I mean, they don't seem to be themselves. I mean, they seem to have lost some of their moral compass recently, particularly under this particular Pope, who I think is a very suspect character. I also think that the Great Reset has everything to do with the present regime, and it's manifesting itself now, because now that you have the states are reasserting their sovereign right to regulate elections and ensure that there's not suppression by fraud, you have all these international corporations marching in and saying, no, you can't do that. You have to keep these methodologies in place that will allow perpetuation of fraud. You're not going to have another free election. You're not going to have a means to actually check one man, one vote. It's going to be this perpetual system where we control. And then if you disagree with us, we're going to claim that you have something against, you know, in this case, African-Americans, but it could be any group that they name. And, you know, they're also implementing, I think, as part of the Great Reset, this race theory, which is very Nazi-like, very much a eugenics movement, where, for example, here in Boston, it's just been revealed that Brigham and Women's Hospital is going to treat people based upon their race. You know, if you're not the right race, you better get in the back of the line. This is eugenics. I mean, this is a neo-Nazi development, in my opinion. I mean, I hope I'm not kicked off YouTube for saying that, but I'm talking about things that are in the news right now, and I am analyzing those things. That's the world we're living in right now. I mean, I just published, I'm publishing short books right now. My most recent, one of my most recent is Toward Fascist America. And I get into why I think this is happening. I think it has everything to do with the Great Reset. And Susan, I think you're basically, in the broad sense, your thesis is correct. I don't agree with some of the particulars, but in the general sense, you are describing this internationalist, globalist, top 1% free trade interlocking entity that controls all aspects of our political, economic, and cultural life, even our religions. And, you know, they've been around since Roman times. I think you make a very good point on that. We can't know the particulars of it because they are secretive. And that's why I'm a little nervous when you talk about, well, the Rothschilds did this and they did that. We don't know that. But we do know that the general method here and the message you have is really, really right on.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I'd like to point out also that these the corporations who are dictating the terms of the election, these are the outgrowth of the old East India Company. They were controlled by the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds through interlocking boards of directors. And it was their money that was poured into the government to control our elected officials. And in turn, they had become very wealthy by, you know, based upon the money they were able to extract from the government. So you're looking at the same kind of forces at work.
Absolutely. Now, Susan, I can't really do the show for more than an hour or else I can't download it into Rumble and Minds and all these other venues. So okay, I'm going to do a series with you. This is a very important topic. You've written a lot of very interesting books. I want to thank you for joining me today, Susan Bradford. Please where they can get your books and how they can get more information about you.
Absolutely.
Okay, you're kind of breaking up on me, but I'll wait and see if we can clear that. Susan Bradford is the author of Royal...
Okay, will do. Thank you for that. I know the internet is a little bit wobbly today, but you can find my books on my website, which is susanbradford.org, and they are also available on Amazon and through the American Free Press bookstore.
Excellent. All right, Susan Bradford, listen, I really appreciate you joining me today. I'd like to do it again, you know, and we should go over all of your books. They're excellent. And thank you for doing what you do.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Look forward to speaking with you soon.
All right, Susan. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Susan. And it should be live on YouTube shortly. It is live on YouTube. Thank you.